Borussia Dortmund, du bist unser Leben. Borussia Dortmund, du nur ganz allein. Borussia Dortmund, hast uns so viel gegeben. Wir sind dir treu und werden's immer sein.
Welcome to episode 69 of the Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London podcast. Today we have a football finance special. Time flies when you're having fun, and it's going to be really interesting because I've got David Hellier, who is a leading sports finance reporter at Bloomberg and Bloomberg Television, and it doesn't get a lot more knowledgeable. I've been reading his articles, and he's the former editor of City AM and a financial writer of many years, and also a football fan, and of which club he will let us know, no doubt. Good afternoon, David.
Hi there, Ben.
That's good stuff. Did I describe you well there?
All good, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm trying to run a sale of a Spanish club at the moment.
Oh, nice. And are we allowed to know which club it is?
Not yet. Not the bigger ones, but it's owned by a Saudi, so I give you a clue.
Brilliant. I've got a few ideas. David, which club do you support?
I support Chelsea. I have done since way before Abramovich and way before Bowley and Bali. I've seen them through the ups and downs of football, including nearly getting relegated to the third tier in England.
Amazing. I think that was in the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is Ken Bates, or just pre-Ken Bates?
I'm pre-Ken Bates, actually. Definitely. The family, I think, owned it before Bates.
Nice.
And then they went very well, and then they built what is now the East Stand to try and upgrade the stadium, and it was a poison chalice, basically, because it was during a very high inflationary period and the cost got out of control and Chelsea ended up selling some of their best players to pay for the stand. And that didn't recover really for 20 odd years.
Amazing. Fascinating. I remember Borussia Dortmund playing there in the Champions League last season. But before we get on to Chelsea and fan life, the show today is about football finances in the context of the DFL, the German governing body of German football, turning down the opportunity to pursue further negotiations to sell media rights. And the fans have played a big role in that. And so to introduce our second guest, who's very much a fan and involved in the world of fans, Mark Meehan, is on the shadow board of Chelsea Football Club, is a long-standing football fan, and has seen the mighty Borussia Dortmund and has some views on German football, and is very keen to contribute to the podcast, and we're very grateful to both of you. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks very much for the invitation, Benjamin. This is the day we've probably lived a very live with our Chelsea supporting history. My first game was 1971, so no sooner did I start supporting Chelsea, about 12 months later, we lose to Stoke City at Wembley, and then went that period David has described of building a stand that will secure our future, and then went into what I affectionately now refer to as the gloomy years, when we spent a considerable period of time in the second division, nearly dropped into the third division, which is now obviously called Division 1 in English football. Delighted where we've been for the last 20 years. Just fortunate to be able to see what I've seen as a Chelsea supporter, but bearing in mind where I actually come from. And yes, as well as I'm one of the supporters that sits on the club's advisory board, which has sprung out of the Tracy Crouch fan-led review of English football. I also chair the Chelsea Supporters Trust. I've done sort of like the last 12 months or so. I've been involved with fan engagement in and out for about the last 30 years. I used to chair the Chelsea Defence Sports Association, also was the former editor of the Chelsea Independent Fan. And I also used to write, going over to the dark side, I used to write formerly for the club magazine until a certain Ken Bates and me were writing for the said magazine or opposite Blue Time. So, yeah, very much coming from a fan viewpoint, you know, fascinated here today with our mentioned application from a financial point of view. And that did chip in on, you know, my current thoughts of like the current model at Chelsea Football Club and potential future models.
You wrote a book about the era under Ken Bates, who was there before Roman Abramovich. And I believe that he's actually sold the club to, or he bought the club for £1. The book was called Blue Tomorrow. And yeah, that was the era 1982 to 2003. And you're also chairman of the Chelsea Supporters Trust and a member of the club's advisory trust. Basically, what do you do? What is the advisory trust? Is it like a shadow board?
It is very much like a shadow board. So I think if we start at, you had the European Super League issue in 2001, and obviously the request then from the government at that time was to Tracy Crouch, who was the former sports minister in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. And she carried out a fan-led review looking at football governance, you know, in English football, made a number of recommendations, and obviously one of those, we'd have to wait and see the outcome of, was obviously the recommendation the government to create a new independent regulator for English football. But obviously one of her proposals also the idea of having a shadow board. Yeah, and that board, shall we say, in inverted commas, would be a number of supporters' representatives that probably many football clubs already have done. They have like what they call fans forums and have had for many years. But this was more sort of probably sitting at sort of like the business strategic level of the football club. So the sort of Chelsea sort of fan advisory board, I got appointed onto it in May of last year. So it's still very early days. We meet with club board members and representatives four times a year. It's not a legal board in any shape or form. So we don't have any sort of like company director responsibility, etc. So it very much looks, if I describe my role, is looking at the strategic yes. vision of the football club, short, medium terms or plans for the club, mm-hmm. and then just operationalish of concern to supporters and wider, you know, such as myself and the 40,000 yeah. people that go to Chelsea every other week. Yeah. And also it looks at other things like heritage. And you might have heard of the concept of what's like called a golden share, and those things that are okay. really important as well, like precious to or like football fans. And you know, the whole idea of like the golden share would be giving to, at this stage, to be a predetermined body, shall
yeah,
we say,
yeah.
But to have a power of veto over sort of future decisions taken by a football club. And some of the things, including the golden share, might be the stadium where a yeah. club plays,
yeah.
The actual name of the football club, any change to the stadium's name. You get all of the dialogue that you've had with Bruce Dortmund, the club badge. I've noticed at the moment Bournemouth are changing their badge. The colour of the shirt, you had Cardiff City changing crazy. From blue to red under Vincent Tan. Yeah. And very important, and most importantly of all, the competitions in which the clubs take part in.
Yeah.
So again, never going down the pathway of a European Super League, bless, you've done it through a proper consultative process, which what did not happen in 2021.
I was going to say.
We meet four times a year. Yeah, we've met a few times already since May of this year. Some of those important issues we talked about. We talked about ticketing. We talked about touting. We talked about secondary markets. We've got about 10 club groups set up now. Anything from the facilities management of the stadium to Chelsea's long-term stadium plans and the sort of heritage of the club as well. So yeah. It's still very much in its infancy. I think both sides, yeah, we're looking to sort of like work together. And you know, it's
yeah.
early. That's probably the best description I could give of my role so far in the advisory board.
That's really interesting. And if I were to mirror that, I mean, essentially, we have an annual general meeting. The 180,000 plus members are divided into different departments. For example, mine is the fan department. At the annual general meeting, we get to vote on key issues like, for example, the adoption of a women's team, which Dortmund now has two of. Or similar things like you suggested. And basically, we are consulted on issues via email and so on. And it's very much an important part of going to the annual general meeting. Is very much an important thing. And basically, as you know, and David will explain a bit more about this, I'm sure, football clubs in Germany are 50+1 percent owned by the fans and cannot therefore be taken over by an investor or a corporation, which is very much about what the sale of the media rights was about, was retaining the hold over the football clubs. And basically saying that we fans and we members are basically the key stakeholders in the club, and we're not willing to give up our independence. David, is that how you see it?
A little bit. In my mind, I sort of slightly see the issues a little bit separate to that. But I think what happened in the end was that they did get conflated and. The 50+1, obviously, I remember when I started writing about German football 4 or 5 years ago, there were lots of Americans trying to buy stakes, and they were all pretty fearful that 50+1 was going to no more quite soon. And basically, they all assumed that it was coming to an end. I don't think they are assuming that. More, if anything, the direction's in the other direction. But I think private equity, to go back a little bit, private equity firms and sports funds, funds generally, profit investment funds that are, gaining a grip on football. I mean, we did a piece about a year ago, and I think the percentage of clubs now owned or part of their funds was something like 17% in the whole year. Come up from virtually nothing 20 years ago, 20 years before this. You have this gradual creep where, funds are like Arsenal Sports stake in Paris Saint-Germain, Erlica, which is a private equity reporter, big stake. Bruga, Elliot, obviously, used to own a band before selling it to another fund, really, Redbird. This is commonplace. But the funds were saying, a lot of the American, they were saying to me that, that they love your football, but they're very kind of wary about relegation. Because you buy into the club and then down, and then you lose the TV money, you lose revenue, things go, you've still got players on high contracts. It's very, very high risk for them. They're looking at things that are less high risk, which are revenues associated to leagues as a whole, because, you spread your risk between the poor performing clubs and the high performing clubs. So they basically, turn their attention to Italy, where they were nearly within a whisker of doing a deal in Italy, when some of the clubs led by Napoli sort of rebelled and basically got cold feet. I think that there's slightly two different issues. One is, the league provide these funds with a sort of spread of risk that they don't get with clubs. Then there's the other issue about the clubs where, they would like to buy German clubs that are more high net worth business people rather than the funds, although some of them are kind of quite close to the fund. But it's rather them that want to buy the clubs. So I do, in my mind, see them slightly separately. At the same time as looking at the infrastructure as a whole, if you allow capitalism into one area, there's a danger that it's a sort of creeping control issue, I suppose.
Absolutely right. I agree with that entirely. The experience has been that German clubs have managed themselves well, successfully in the more commercial era of the last 20 years, and have managed to turn over a good amount of money, have managed to result in a profit, have managed to subsidize, you know, very successful teams, have managed to build a strong youth policy, have managed to feed into a strong national team, which has won the World Cup four times, and have managed to compete very well in Europe. Admittedly, it's usually Bayern Munich who are competing for the silverware in Europe. But Germans have kind of got used to the idea that, you know, they have one team which is above all others in some ways. And I wouldn't say that German fans are okay with that, but I would say that they accept that Bayern Munich is from the richest region in Bavaria and Munich. And Bayern hasn't always been the dominant club. It's been FC Cologne, it's been Hamburg, it's been... you know, Werder Bremen at different times, it's been Borussia Dortmund and so on. And so I think, you know, I think the main thing is that they're essentially well-run clubs in which fans have a stake. And that stake that they have, an ability to make decisions and, you know, that community rootedness is something which fans are not keen to give up. And I think exactly as you say, David, they're very worried about corporations coming in and taking away that those interests and controlling and managing things too much, whether it's the fan experience or whether it's just kickoff times and other things, which I think they felt very, very worried about. Mark, what comes to mind for you then hearing that about German football and the way it's managed and also the contrast with the way things are and your experience of, for example, back in the day when, you know, when English fans were more kind of fan-led, I would say, although there has always been a tradition of big companies, you know, football clubs coming out of factories and so on. And, you know, so I think, you know, the tradition is slightly different. But at the same note, I think that fans' interests have been eroded in English football. Wouldn't you agree, Mark?
I would say I think there's always been an affinity between English and German football, despite some of the sort of like historic sort of matches. I think there is a lot of similarity, and I think, as I say, when I've ever been going to European games, it's always sort of like the German trips I look forward to most, because I see that affinity between English fans and German fans rather than sort of the rest of Europe. I think what I would say is actually not eroding it. I think the landscape. You know, I think the landscape in English football has dramatically changed. Whether you say that from an ownership point of view, that has dramatically changed from the Butchers and Bakers and Catholic Bakers of the 1960s to this multi-club ownership model now. But ultimately, I think it comes back to whether you've got shareholders or hedge funds. Ultimately, I accept, you know, owners may have a different viewpoint to myself. But ultimately, football clubs belong to the supporters.
Yes, I agree.
Without the supporters, football clubs are nothing. And we saw during the pandemic, and I know it started in Germany first, and again, we followed the German example and came quickly back to showing football during the pandemic because Germany was first. Everybody said how awful it was watching football in an empty stadium. So you've got to get the balance right, whatever model you go for, you know, in English football. Without supporters being in the stadium, TV companies aren't interested, and it's a very dull thing. So the clubs belong to the supporters. Everybody that goes every week, they are those supporters. And I do think it's important, and I would say this, having been in fan engagement for about 30 years, it is important that football supporters' voices are heard.
Yeah.
So very much my role has always been, whether I'm on the supporters' trust and what I've done in the past, and write and edit fans.
Yeah.
I'm acting basically to promote my football club, but the supporters of that football club. And I've always said it is really important. So it is in its infancy, the concept of whether you call them shadow boards or fan advisory board. I've always said it's important, you know, that supporters have some voice or representation. And I think it's going to be interesting the journey we are on in English football, because every single club is going down this pathway because they can see what's coming with the regulator. Clubs are setting up their shadow boards, advisory boards. And for my own club, and I have to accept what they've said, and you know, will develop over a period of time, themselves, they want to be a trailblazer in support engagement. Well, great. I'm delighted to hear that's their school of thought. So I think it's going to be interesting how we work with that administration over the coming months and years, that they do become that role model, that example. of doing the right things and working with supporters going forward. And actually sort of like, you know, setting up a good relationship, you know, between the club and its fan base. And, I don't think every single football club can say that. Over the time I look at Reading at the moment, and watch that example also in German football as well, where you see supporters demonstrating because, you know, they're not happy about what's happening with their football club or football club's being paid. Yeah. And that's another reason why the Super League happens.
Yeah.
You know, people were really angry and upset that they saw what was precious to them, i.e. their team and going to watch football, you know, every Saturday, was at the risk of, you know, taking away. And I go to one of the Chelsea supporters' point of view. There's a song that we sing, you know, the last line of the song is, please don't take my Chelsea away.
It's really
important to Chelsea fans and football fans in general. That's why there was this huge pushback starting at Chelsea, but other supporters groups as well, because people did not want the European Super League.
And as I say, I mean, out of it, quite surprised it happened in the way it did.
Yeah. David, do you...
I mean, do you understand, Mark, do you understand why we came out strongly against it?
I think very much why Chelsea supporters came out strongly against it. I was very much opposed to the idea of like a European Super League. That, you know, they may not even be able to go and watch their team. Also, they were strong supporters of what the English football pyramid was, and they want to see promotion, they want to see relegation. And obviously, Chelsea were the first to sort of, shall we say, fold very quickly and move away from that. And I'm not sure whether we'll ever go back there, because obviously, if we get, whether this government or a future government, the introduction of a regulator, it will be very interesting to see the line the regulator takes about future European Super League. Most football fans, I think, are very, where I think I agree with you, Benjamin, I think are different to German football fans. I don't think English football fans are necessarily as radical as their German counterparts, shall we say.
Yeah.
And that's the surprising thing about the European Super League demonstration is, I've been going to see, as I said, for nearly 50 years, I can count fingers of one hand where I see Chelsea supporters really get that agitated. And that was a prime example of that. So, as I said, you know, people were so concerned that they might not be able to go against their team, they took to the streets of the Fulham Road.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. David, in a week when Rochdale and Torquay are on the ropes, when, you know, we've seen other clubs like Bury in the past, and about 40 different English clubs, and quite a number have gone to the wall entirely. I was down at Chichester City at the weekend, and they were reformed in 2000, being a club dating back to the 19th century. And, you know, everything but everything had been stripped out of them in terms of tradition, in terms of culture. They didn't even have a proper pitch, to be frank. And it was an enjoyable game. I was grateful to spend the afternoon with them, watch them beat Sevenoaks, but in the Isthmian League. But at the same note, I kind of wonder, David, whether you feel that... what's the contrast for you between the way German clubs are run in terms of finances? And also, do you think that English game is sustainable when this amount of clubs are actually going bankrupt? And do you not trust football clubs to be able to run themselves as they do in Germany?
Now time for a short announcement. If you love Borussia Dortmund, why not join us for a live game and have a couple of Dortmund Union beers at the Stammtisch meetup of the official Borussia Dortmund fan club in London? We meet on match days at the Fitzroy Wine Cellar on Cleveland Street. For more details, head to our Facebook page or give us a call on 07459-394-121. And now, back to the show.
Let's see. I'd say, I mean, German clubs appear to be more conservative, less likely to rack up huge debts. You know, the transfer market seems to be more subdued. I mean, obviously the variations there, Bayern has, you know, got plenty of money. But I think, you know, it's a lot of the issues with English clubs have come because of, you know, ownership issues. I mean, Reading is a example. The guy who runs Reading has just, you know, not paid his bills, the whole series of not even paid his, you know, players heating, you know, I mean, the same does in the training ground and stuff. But it's kind of not through lavish spending, particularly at Reading, you know, his finances have just not been governed properly. And so there's a governance issue, I think, where you've got these really out of control owners. Mm. And maybe we need to be much more, you know, much careful about the kind of owners that we, you know, we make fit and proper. I mean, we have to, you know, like there's seven deal for Everton at the moment that's been going on. There's so much about 777 that, you know, it would be very surprising if they're allowed to take over. Unless they can kind of come up with cast iron guarantees. I don't know. There is something that seems to be rotten about the governance in English clubs. I don't know the German scene quite as well, so I don't know too many examples.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dai Young is certainly no John Madejski, who actually has done a lot for the arts as well as football and built that beautiful stadium, which I attended a conference at. And Reading Football Club, you know, Premier League for a long time, and certainly a club which, you know, very well supported and so on, and should be doing well. And I completely get where you're coming from. And Mark, when you see the level of debt in English football, I mean, you know, particularly Manchester United, I was up at Old Trafford against Wolves on the opening game of the Premier League. And, you know, fantastic stadium, but very, very old stadium. You know, to think that the owners have geared the club up with £500 million worth of debt and then ultimately leaving the beautiful Old Trafford Stadium to rot. Doesn't that, when you go out to Germany and you see, for example, now the European Championships in the summer and so on, and you realize that a lot of the grounds in Germany are owned by the cities and the communities, and that the communities will not just build the stadiums, but will run them and then rent them to the football clubs. Doesn't that kind of, that stability and that kind of, you know, sense of community and a communal ownership, doesn't that kind of give you more of a sense of kind of confidence in the fortunes of the clubs going forward?
Oh, no, definitely. But what I've always, what we've always said from the Supporters Trust point of view, is a football club itself, irrespective of who owns it, it has an important role. It's an asset of community value. It has a really important role to play in the community. And it's another reason why, certainly in many parts of like the country, people are so passionate about football. It's a bit different than sort of some of the more modern stadiums are more out of town. But, you know, the traditional history of English football, you know, very much was, you know, attached to sort of like certain towns and sort of like certain industries. So it was the local team, the local community, etc. So there is something in that about, you know, the role, you know, the stadium and the football club plays, you know, in their own community. But I'd also agree with David's point as well, is, you know, there is something around like corporate football governance. I don't know if it's something that Tracy Croucher, you actually picked up.
Yes.
Is that there needs to be a sort of difference, shall we say? I think there's nothing wrong with people coming into football if they are the right and proper person,
yeah,
to actually
sure.
look after that community asset, that football club and its stadium, and play an important role in that community. But we've seen too many examples where people may have come into football for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
We've seen it with Reading being the most recent example. We've seen it Bury and Macclesfield, you know, and clubs going to the wall.
Yeah.
Because the people that took them over did not look after that asset that was really important to the local community. And I think that's why it is really important, whatever that fit and proper person test in future will be, is going to be really, really key, because too many people have come into football and still football clubs as a result of that. And that has a dramatic impact on the local team if there's no longer a local team to go and watch on a Saturday.
Absolutely. David, how are the Americans, essentially the venture capital companies and so on, how are they actually making money? Because a friend of mine, Cameron, runs one of these investment funds, and he says to me, and I think this echoes what Alan Sugar said, is that basically it's a bottomless pit. I mean, a lot of money comes in, but you can't make money in football.
Yeah, I mean that's quite often the case, isn't it? I'd say that, I mean the Glazer family who put Manchester United in 2005, they did take money out of football, and you know, an asset that was valued at what, 700 million, and then it's now sort of 4.5 million or so. Haven't sold out altogether. They've sold their 28% stake or something. So I think people come in and they look at asset prices. I'm sure Todd Bowley did this when he studied it, you know, when he bought Chelsea. A world in which Chelsea would be worth a lot more than he paid. And yet he must also have realised that it's going to be a very expensive time, you know, in the short term at least, in sort of repositioning the club, that kind of thing. The Americans have lost lots of money. Ellis Shorter, Sandler, Bradley Werner, Aston Villa being two.
Yeah.
On it. And Elliot's done quite well as England. I mean, seems to have, you know, bought the club at its rock bottom and then sold it to Redbird and now providing Redbird with a loan. But that's been one of the most, you know, profitable turnarounds in European football in recent times. But yeah, football, it doesn't see a sort of regular income or a regular dividend or anything like that. I think, you know, what these people are looking for, Wagner came into Birmingham and said he's looking for a club that is maybe on the way up, although it's going to prove, it's already proved more difficult, I think, than Ian. The people who bought Leeds United, I mean, they may well see Leeds up again. Leeds got it, you know, 49 have got it, got their half.
Yeah. Do you feel that the American owners might end up bailing out?
I mean, I think they might. I think they might. I mean, I think they all come. It amazes me, really, but they all come here with such high hopes, and they're going to follow a stable path and a sensible plan and this kind of thing. But they seem to get themselves into such difficult positions. You know, I mean, like, you know, the Birmingham thing. You know, that they were doing very nicely with the manager who just wasn't very, you know, I mean, he wasn't very glamorous, so they're going to get Wayne Rooney, who's better known than in America. But I mean, it turns out to be a disaster. I don't know, I sort of sometimes feel that they kind of bring with them sort of arrogance of how they do things in America, how things are done, and try to replicate that here.
I agree. I think John Eustace was doing a very good job at City on the whole. I mean, Jude Bellingham came out of the City Academy and he's now one of the best players in the world. Mark, what has been your experience in terms of the club changing hands from Ken Bates to Roman Abramovich to Todd Bowley? I mean, to be frank with you, I write about the Bundesliga kind of out of my fandom has come a doing the PhD and also, a lot of translating and writing of German work and also this podcast. But I just wanted to say that, you know, from a German, looking at it from a Bundesliga perspective, I mean, Dortmund's, you know, the most they've ever played for a player is 30 million, which is about, you know, in the Premier League, you get a sort of middling to average player. And this is for our absolutely top players. And a lot of Dortmund players are bought for like 10, 15 million. And we literally, as Bundesliga fans, look upon a club like Chelsea. And not only are we laughing our heads off half the time at you guys paying like 70 million for Christian Pulisic or whatever, who we got for nothing. But we're also completely astonished at the sheer volume. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the sheer volume of money that is being spent and the quality of the players that end up basically just kind of, you know, just going through the club and essentially then being sold on and often at a loss as well. And I'm not just talking about Chelsea at all, but Chelsea is in under Todd Bowley has been one of the worst clubs in terms of, you know, the churn and burn of outstanding talented players.
you could probably have a whole show on this. You took it back to sort of like Ken Bates and then Roman Abramovich. I think you've almost got sort of like history repeating itself, that there's a price and there's a Chelsea price. So yeah. When obviously Roman Abramovich came in 20 years ago and very much firing pound note across David Dean's lawn, I think was the term used at the time.
Yeah.
We very much spent a lot of money in a short period of time. Probably what was above what the marketplace was. So we probably changed the transfer landscape in English and then European football.
Yeah.
And sort of 20 years on, we're now sort of seeing sort of similar large amounts of money being spent by Chelsea Football Club. But I think it's going to have to level up. If I'm honest, I think paying £100 million for two midfield players is way over what they're worth.
Yeah.
I don't think those other sports will veer for that path. Yes, you want to buy sort of like the best players that are out of the market with the money that you've got available. And clearly, as part of the Abramovich deal, he wanted provision made for money to continue spent on transfers. But there's also a negotiating skill actually that you don't get, we say, overpriced for a player. And we've got two good midfield players in Fernandes and Caicedo. But I think most football fans would say, we've probably had to pay over the market to get those players. So, I think it's probably far too early. We've spent £1 billion, and clearly the team isn't where it should be at this present moment in time. Because I think the point you were talking about in the last conversation and about finances,
yes,
for me, the whole Chelsea, you've got to have a long-term vision on this. You know, you've got to have a strategic vision that is long-term. You're not going to sort of like make money. I think you'll make money eventually for Chelsea Football Club. If you look at what Abramovich paid Bates and what Abramovich sold the club for, the sale was forced on Abramovich.
Yes.
In 10 years' time, if Todd Boehly and Clearlake sold the club, they'd receive more than what they paid for it. But that's in 10 years' time. It'd take a while for that to actually come through. There's no profit to be made on Chelsea currently. So I would say we probably need to wait and see what happens. And obviously they've gone down the amortisation route about the players. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. If all those players that we've bought turn out to be really successful, you know, that's a very clever strategic plan. But I think we have to wait and see. What I would say is, with all that money, we should have bought an out-and-out goal scorer.
Yeah, well, you tried our old player, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, yeah. It's amazing watching Aubameyang score goals now. He didn't look like he was going to get money for us, did he?
No, not at all. No, Aubameyang, wherever he's been very good, and he's scored goals at Marseille now. I don't know what happened while he was at Chelsea.
Yeah.
Clearly, did not work out. And he's a class European striker.
Yeah.
Maybe he only wanted to play for Thomas Tuchel. Didn't want to play for Graham Potter.
Yeah.
I can imagine that you don't want to talk about Graham Potter very much, although he was a great.
Yeah. Well, he was
He was great at Brighton. David, talking about the media rights deal, obviously the Premier League has got a much bigger media rights deal of $6.7 billion, but the Bundesliga follows and not much less than that, and. How much of a difference do you think it makes in terms of English club success, in terms of that media rights deal? Do you think that German clubs basically use the media rights deal to subsidize loss-making aspects of their business, basically? Is that why they managed to keep the tickets so cheap? And, I mean, you know, do you see the dominance of the Premier League going on forever, basically, on the amount of money that is coming in?
Well, I don't know. I mean, given the amount of money that the Premier League has from media, I would expect sort of, you know, them to be doing much better than they are really in Champions League. We've got, I think, two clubs now, haven't we, in the last 16, Arsenal and City, out of four. They I mean, there was a time period of about, I don't know, 3 years ago when I think we were regularly getting 3 in the finals. That seems to have actually, you know, we've gone backwards a little. I mean, I just think it's remarkable that, you know, teams like Burnley, not Leicester now, but, you know, Burnley, Crystal Palace, all these things, they can sort 40, 50 million pound players from Europe. The German media deal is, I think, a lot better than it could be. I honestly believe that, it's an amazing product. But when you look at it, say, in the coverage in England that Sky does, they show the match. There's not much support material. It's not, you know, there aren't the documentaries looking at the fan culture. And there wasn't really any proper, about the fans, what they were about. You know, you watch the game and you just see the game and that's it. They don't, even when the balls are being thrown on the pitch, they don't really get much comics there. And I think that, you know, on the whole, the German game, you know, it's been sold short a bit. So I had several conversations with football execs and you said, you know, we need somebody to kind of make this better. We need somebody that gives us a higher profile. And I would say to them, but surely you need somebody that knows about media, that knows about marketing. You don't really need private equity. And they were saying, yeah, but private equity's got all this expertise and they were convinced that that was the way to go. And I think it was really more that they went to private equity not because, you know, thought the financial deal was the right one. They went there because they were looking for something, somebody that could give them an insight in how to put the genie out of the bottle and really promote German football on a global landscape. And I don't know what it's going to be, what it's going to take to get there. But I still feel specifically that there is the potential there because it is a. It's a fascinating product, really. I mean, you've got the Kaiserslautern tradition. You've got the Schalke being, you know, getting 61,000 in second division. You've got a lot. You know, you've got Fortuna Düsseldorf filling their stadiums with this new initiative they've got.
Complimentary tickets, 30% of them.
There are sort of interesting things about them. Football, they're just not. They're not really being projected. Whereas Premier League is sort of, you know, a bit glitzy and all the rest of it. And has a lot of good players. When you broadcast a game between Dortmund and whoever, just listening to that wall of noise, you know, it's pretty amazing. The TV could make something of that.
I absolutely agree, and I'd like to just say,
fans in Germany is so strong.
Absolutely right, and I think what your emphasis on the fact that a lot of German football's attraction, and I'm sure Mark would agree, is the fact that the fan culture is very vivid, very alive, and the fans contribute a lot in terms of the narrative and the conversation. And as an observer, keen observer, Borussia of German football. I would say that my observation is that, I mean, you only need to look at the social media following to see that Bundesliga has 10% of La Liga and even less than what Premier League has worldwide. And whilst you can argue that the English language and England's or Great Britain's kind of involvement in a lot of territories and countries around the world and so on historically has meant that people in Africa and Asia and so on are more likely to be interested in English, you know, cultural products like bands in the past and, you know, famous bands, but also obviously football and so on, which they can easily relate to because they can speak the language, they can read the news and so on. They're familiar with the names and things like that. But on the same note, I mean, I think it's very evident that whilst Germany makes extraordinarily brilliant products in terms of their machinery and cars and other products that they make, you know, which made in Germany has been I have to say it makes me sad as an English person to think that made in England doesn't mean anything anymore, whereas made in Germany still stands for absolutely outstanding quality, whether it's, you know, your kitchen or whether it's your Volkswagen car or your Audi or your BMW or whatever. And I think that, you know, Germany are not as good at kind of selling themselves, and they have that kind of reservations about their own products. And as you and Mark today have kind of, you know, said from your own experience, the German football product is a really, really good one. And, you know, it's stable, it's balanced, it produces outstanding talents, and it also produces an outstanding football experience for fans and for viewers alike. And what I really love is that they actually play a very beautiful, disciplined type of football, which is really beautiful on the eye as well. I don't know what your observation is, Mark.
No, I wouldn't disagree. I think, you know, as I said at the start of this, that, you know, big fan of like German football, but also the sort of German fan culture as well. They do think the right way. I'd also say, also be careful what you wish for as well, because to be honest, if I was a German fan, I wouldn't be bothered about how many social media followers you've got, you know, where in the world they come from, because we've got 25.5 million Twitter followers. To be honest, I don't care. You know, how many Twitter followers. You know, some of the club, I don't actually care, because of that 25 million, I bet many of them also follow Real Madrid. They follow Paris Saint-Germain. They might follow Manchester United, you know, Arsenal and Liverpool as well. So they're not necessarily supporters of the football club, yeah. So they might follow them on social media, and or they might look at a TikTok video, but that's for me the be all and end all. And sometimes with social media, you get negative parts to that as well. That you get the whole Twitter social media influencer follower, and sadly, some of them are complete and utter idiots that actually they're more interested when they go to the game actually about growing their fan base and their followers than actually watching what's in front of them. If I had my way, I wouldn't have anyone to film a football match. And actually most ground regulations actually say if you use something to the detriment or annoyance of other football fans, you're not allowed to use your phone. But a bit like the Premier League and money, I think the genie's unfortunately out of the bottle now in England.
Yeah,
may not be able to put it back on. Yeah.
So, Mark, would it be fair to say that English fans on the whole are quite happy to go down the experiment of trying out American marketing techniques on their football clubs to see whether that it can produce, you know, massive success stories like the San Francisco 49ers or, you know, or the New York Yankees and that kind of thing? Global brands with excellent merchandise and brilliantly marketed and, you know, that kind of thing. And take the game to a whole different level. Is that what you're saying? That English fans on the whole are happy with that idea?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I think it's who the brand is, shall we say. I think it's quite important as well. I think if it was a worldwide known brand that I think is well regarded and acceptable by most football fans, I think it would be positive. And I'll give the example. One of the issues that had with the club in the last few years is around sponsorship. And the club has done a fantastic amount of work through its foundation around sort of like mental health and well-being and the dangers of gambling. And
bad.
Yeah, I'm not saying you can't bet people bet people for years. But they were embarking potentially on a sponsorship deal with a betting company.
Yeah.
And I just thought, and many other sports thought, do you know that's the wrong pathway to go down? So we surveyed our membership came back with a huge response saying, I actually don't want a football club, you know, to be associated, you know, with the gambling firm on the front of their shirt.
Absolutely right.
Messages. Yeah. So again, it's really important who the brand is. We've also had a bit of negative publicity quite recently where I got no problem with Hilton Hotels. I think,
Yeah.
I've stayed in them. But, you know, it's a different marketplace in women's football.
Yeah.
We had a bed set up in one of our states. So it's, you know, you've got to be really careful. As I said, football is a community.
Yeah.
You know, your supporters are part of that community. Be careful what brands you use. You know, nothing wrong with shit. Okay, what I would say if you look at, say, like Premier League clubs, and look at my own club, for example,
yeah,
in terms of sponsorship income, I think we punch above our weight.
We're
fifth or sixth in the Premier League in terms of sponsorship income.
Yeah.
It's the right sponsors, not the wrong sponsors. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I gotcha.
Whether a local brand or a worldwide brand, it's got to be the right brand.
I got you, absolutely.
I didn't think a betting company was the right brand.
No, and the proliferation of betting companies has gone pretty mental in English football, I would say. David and Mark, mindful of the time, the German football media rights deal is 4.4 billion, which is a hell of a lot of money, basically, and it's not far off what the English clubs get. It's pretty evident to me that they cross-subsidise in order to keep the tickets low and, and to have the stadiums full, which is really working for Germany. But I have no doubt at all that the Germans are not that good at marketing, because I see it every single day. David, what's your view on the whole of the media deal that they were proposing to sell media rights to CBC, similar to what the Spanish and the French did? And the Spanish and the French, as you and I discussed, have had very mixed experiences. I mean, yes, I do think there might have been some element of marketing expertise, but I mean, the Germans are also doing other deals with the NFL and other people to try and learn from them. So, and they're also doing some cross-fertilization with American football, which is working successfully. So does German Bundesliga really need, and would it have made a huge difference to have got that billion euros?
Yeah, I have some, a number of executives about this, and I constantly say, what makes you think these private equity are basically doing a financial, which will be very complicated in the long run. What makes you think they can actually add anything creatively to what you have? You couldn't get from hiring top people, and maybe if you had to fund that with a bank loan or something, you could do that. And the issue of keeping ticket prices, I'm so against what happens in England, where where prices have gone up so much for so many years, where you kind of priced out people in their 20s, late teens, that kind of thing. I really think that in England we do get much from media that we can sort of subsidize the ticket pricing. Even if you have a lot, you can have, like at Chelsea, I think we have about 10,000 corporate tickets. Well, that brings in massive amount of revenue. So I think for the others, the rest of the people, for the season ticket holders, we should be the tickets coming up too much. Chelsea, to be fair, is not the most expensive, because under
promotion,
quite low. But there's a lot of clubs, Tottenham, Arsenal, where they're going up really, really high.
Yes.
And there's not a lot of young people going to football in England, and that's different in Germany.
Absolutely right. Yeah. I want to give the last word to Mark. Mark, any observations, ideas that have come up? I mean, what it's become very clear is that the Premier League is a very well-marketed club, that they're willing to take experiments with the American corporate model of marketing. But at the same time, as David was saying, the American companies haven't always had success. It can be somewhat fickle. And also they've geared and leveraged and added a lot of debt to some of the football clubs here in England, which may not be sustainable in the long run. The Germans are not that good at marketing themselves, and they can learn also, like we can, from the marketing. But obviously the fans want to maintain their stake in German football, and that has its advantages because German football is cheaper, and also all strata of society, from unemployed people to younger people, can go, pensioners and so on. And the season tickets, as we know, are much cheaper. I mean, £3,000 at Arsenal, £800 at Dortmund for the very best seats, and Arsenal or Tottenham, whatever, can go up even higher. Mark, on the whole, basically, what would you say, what's your kind of overall observation? Do you think that the German model is the right way forward, or do you think that English football is going to continue to be eating up ground?
I think you probably have to merge and get the best of both worlds. I think the difficulty is, as much as I like the German model, and there's a lot to be said for that, as I said, with the lid being taken off of the Pandora's box that is English football, starting with 30 years ago with the Premier League, I think it'd be hard to put that back on.
Yes.
Go back to what it was before. So I think it's a hybrid of the two. Take the best of what the German model, fan culture, I think something to be applauded is their pricing policy and their approach. But even small little things as well. What I liked when I went to Dortmund last year is if you have a match ticket, public transport, that was part of your ticket.
That's absolutely right.
You travel free. So that's those small little things. It all adds up. Going to football is expensive. So that's
absolutely right.
You appreciate as a football fan. I think the other thing is, I think there is a lot to be said. And David made mention of that ticket pricing as well. No, we're not the most expensive. And I do worry when I see that Fulham are the most expensive season ticket with the building of their new stand. And there's been protests by a Fulham fan, which is unique, I think, in the history of sort of Fulham football. I think that there's a really important conversation about pricing and ticketing to be had. There isn't a bottomless pit with supporters. There is a cost of living crisis. And
I
finished probably on a sort of German note. It may be a very old quote, but someone posted this on social media in England like last week. And it was the former president for Bayern Munich, Uli Hoeneß.
Yeah, Uli Hoeneß.
And I don't know, you might know Benji when he said this. We could charge more than £104. Let's say we charge £300. We'd get 2 million more in income. But what is 2 million to us? In a transfer discussion, you argue about sum of money for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But the difference between £104 and £300 is huge for a football fan.
Absolutely.
We do not think the fans are cows you can keep milking. Earlier said this, football has got to be for everybody. And I think, you know, he's got it, football has to be for everybody. You've got to have that balance.
Spot on, mate.
David mentioned, you mentioned the hospitality. Yeah, Chelsea being lucky, I think there hasn't been a price increase since about 2005-06. So it's quite a long time. So it's been helped by the sort of rise, you know, of the sort of corporate hospitality market. That's helped keep prices down. You've got to get the best of both worlds. If you look at what we've got at Chelsea, I think I'm guessing here, but out of a 40,000 stadium, we've probably got 25,000, 26,000 season ticket holders.
Yeah.
I don't know what hospitality season tickets cost. I know where we are in terms of league tables with the most expensive ticket and the least expensive.
Yeah, sure.
But if we say somewhere £1,000 to £1,500 is the average ticket at Chelsea.
Yeah.
And then that by 20, and that brings you in less than £40 million, which is, I accept, a lot of money. But then if you look at match day income and look at a club like Chelsea, in Deloitte tables of last month, our match day income, which isn't just about ticket revenue, was £8 million.
Yeah.
You know, so
outstanding. You
know, so there's other money being spent there, and we're still ranked quite highly. It's still, in the grand scheme of things, a small amount of money when you're looking at television deals that go into sort of like hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds.
I got you.
At Chelsea, as I said, 250 million, 200, 300 million on broadcasting.
Yeah.
Commercial income's the same from Deloitte tables.
Income
is a much smaller part of it. The money in football now isn't through the turnstile. It's through sponsorship and television and commercial.
And you know what, Mark? You know what? You're still playing over the odds to go and watch your game, and you still have no stake in the game. And that's why a lot of us are following the Bundesliga now and doing it with with an element of schadenfreude as well, and just watching on as a lot of money is burnt, basically. And, you know, it just doesn't seem right, in my opinion. But, you know, I still go and watch my local team, Portsmouth FC, and enjoy it, yeah. But, a last question to close. David, will we see a European Super League 2.0?
We'll see lots of attempts to do it, and the next one will be less closed than it was. You know, there'll be some element of promotion and relegation, but not enough, in my view. And I think it's hard to get something that fits with all the other competitions that we've got at the moment. I mean, you know, you need to, like with all the domestics, you need to have a prize at the end of it, and the prize is Europe. So you need, like, you know, three or four clubs fight to the end of the season, because otherwise they're not so interesting and you diminish. So it's very hard to come up with something that integrates everything that you need.
Yeah.
And remains different to the Champions
League. Absolutely spot on. Mark, European Super League, would the Chelsea fans let it go through? Is there any chance of it being a success?
That's a very good question.
I'm going to need a quick reply.
I would be very surprised if Chelsea supporters voted for a European Super League, bearing in mind they were the one that took to the streets of Fulham Road only 3 years ago. So I don't think there'd be a European Super League that I can foresee in the future.
Nice one, guys. Borussia Dortmund.